This is the State of Things broadcast from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Melinda Pencava. Sarah Hall's second book, The Electric Michelangelo, explores the seediness of the tattoo industry as well as the artistry of tattooing. And along the way, Sarah Hall takes readers to places that become characters in themselves. The story in Electric Michelangelo is set on two shores, a weary seaside town in England and in Coney Island. Sarah Hall herself divides her time between her native England and North Carolina, and she joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Well, your book is set in a small coastal town. Initially, it's set in a small coastal town in England, and it's a seaside town, a tourist town, a little worse for the wear.
That's right, yeah. It's Morecambe in the north of England, northwest coast of England, and it used to be a thriving seaside community, and it's still very popular. It's a little shabby now, kind of has a nostalgic feel to it, you know, if you raggedy-looking donkeys walking along the prom and people sitting out in deck chairs, but it still has a really nice, old-fashioned, you know, you'd go there and buy an ice cream kind of feel to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is where Psy is growing up, and this is starting out in the early 1900s, right?
That's right, yeah.
And you describe the place as his boarding house where he grows up as a place that looks as though it's been set, and I'm quoting here, within a row of similar poorly brushed ivories and a lower set of teeth.
That's right, yeah. Kind of stained and a little bit shabby. You find a lot of these old buildings on the coast of Britain get this kind of look to them. You know, they're battered by the elements and they come away looking a little bit sorry for themselves. The town itself kind of catered to, we're looking at like the 1920s, 30s, 40s here, catered to the working classes of the north of England, more or less. And these people would get a week off from the mill or the factory or the foundry, wherever they were working, and they'd come along to Morecambe for 7 days of, you know, a holiday where the good, clean, salty air was going to restore their health and remove all the black lung and everything else that they were suffering from. Yeah, so from the beginning, I try and create this kind of, you know, fun but kind of cheap holiday town.
Well, we'll get into talking about Psy in a moment, but I was wondering if you might read a passage for us that gets to that issue of what folks came to Morecambe for.
Sure. When the tide went out, the crowds came in. Sandy, stony mud was eclipsed by a covering of bright bathing towels, fluttering tents and swaying sunshades. From his window in the hotel, it seemed to Psy a delightful, wonderful thing, a jester's costume draped all across the beach. Hundreds of pale and lumpy legs appeared from under clothing. Skin pinked and peeled, lotions were applied too late to sore knees and rosy shoulders. Flowery capped heads bobbed up and down in the water, and feet splashed in the waves. Boys a little older than Psy, in shorts and paper hats, moved in and out of the heliolatrous northern masses, and the striped red tents selling winkles and jellied eels and warm orange syrup, swapping information as to where the breasts were biggest, where the legs were shapeliest, and where the bathing suits were lowest. Even the rain, reliable and persistent when it decided to appear, could not dampen the celebratory spirit of the promenade. People ran laughing and shrieking, either into the sea, where wetness would not matter, or into the cafes and public houses of the town, leaving sand prints on the seats and tablecloths when they departed. And the evening's merry entertainment simply got started a little early. There was no silver service, no operatic gowns, there were no foreign spoils, silks brought back for daughters, fine wine for sons, nor artistic decorated objects purchased for a collection. A postcard home, a box of sugar rock, or a slab of toffee, a fond memory or two of the easy banter that arose from the collective solidarity of the poor but jovial masses, and from the unity of those around you who were in the same boat, so you were all in it together, was souvenir enough for Morecambe's crowds. It was a place where England's working weary came to laugh and sing and cast away their cares, if only for a brief and temporary spell.
Sarah Hall reading from her novel, The Electric Michelangelo. Did you go to such a place as a child?
I did. I was familiar with Morecambe Bay because it's very close to where I was brought up in the north of England. But we actually went down to the Kent coast, which is on the southern shore of Britain. And I went down with my parents and my brother every year, and very similar kind of, you know, seaside town with the shingle beaches. So it wasn't very comfortable, you know, no white sand to kind of spread your beach towel on.
When you say shingled beaches, does that mean
you know, shingle,
rocky?
Just kind of rocky, okay. And, you know, the kind of stuff stuff that will clatter every time a wave comes in. You know, there's that kind of tambourine of like little rocks banging on each other. And we went around the same six castles in the area every time we were down there. But, you know, there's something about the familiarity of it that we just loved as kids. We really did.
Mm-hmm. Well, you would have gone there as a tourist, but Sai, who's the main character in your novel, is very much of that place. I mean, his mother runs a hotel / boarding house. And he sees a very adult world from a very early age. I mean, his mother takes in people who have tuberculosis, and
that's
he
right.
has to carry pans for that. Abortions are performed there.
That's right.
And so he grows up pretty quickly.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And this kind of comes back to his eventual profession, which is the tattoo artist. And I was kind of wondering, you know, what goes into making a tattoo artist? It's such a strange occupation. You must kind of have to come to terms with the human body fairly early on in life. So I thought, you know, I'd set up this kind of interesting, darker, possibly slightly occult world for him that he has to learn to cope with. And whether or not he's comfortable with it early on, which he really isn't, he eventually reconciles all these elements of humanity, and then he's able to go on and into this strange profession. Mm.
For you, what does tattooing represent here?
Well, I love it as an art form. I really like a lot of folk art, you know, the kind of bold, rudimentary style of art that most people can kind of take up and do if they want to. You know, it's something ordinary that everybody can be involved with. And I love that aspect of folk art. But I think the thing that was behind tattooing for me that I found interesting and have tried to kind of write a little bit about in the book is the idea of identity and how identity can be expressed on the human body in these terms. Usually tattoos are kind of socially significant. They're all very symbolic, especially in the West. You know, all the motifs are symbols for something. So people have chosen, you know, to get work done, to kind of commemorate something in their life, you know, to celebrate it. And these can be terrible things as well as good things, you know, the birth of a child or the death of a parent. You know, there is a very bipolar sense to tattooing, you know, the good and the bad of life and how you're going to mark it on yourself. How are you going to celebrate it and remember it in life?
Do you have tattoos yourself?
I have two tattoos, which is kind of one that's been extended into a larger one over the years. I had the first one done about 10 years ago in New York, and it was a terrifying experience and somehow exhilarating too. So I was interested in tattooing a long time ago. And one of the things I remember is my grandfather was tattooed too. And I don't remember much about him because he died when I was very, very young. This is my maternal grandfather. But what I remember, other than him making lovely hot chocolate, was he had navel tattoos on his forearms. And as a kid, you don't really understand this. You know, I would try and kind of remove the marks on his arms and they wouldn't go.
Like maritime tattoos? Like
that's right, yeah, the classic kind of navel tattoo markings.
Now, had he been in the Navy or had he worked
had,
at
yes,
sea?
He had, yeah, that's right. So I think that kind of stuck with me as a curiosity. You know, things like this, you know, the small things of childhood tend to stick with you.
Sure. So Sai becomes the electric Michelangelo. And there have been some references about your book that the Sistine Chapel for this Michelangelo is a woman named Grace, who he meets after he has emigrated to New York, to Coney Island.
Another
seaside tourist town.
That's right, just a bigger version of Morecambe.
And this woman named Grace, she has a very special tattoo that she wants done.
She does, yes. She, first of all, she's going to go for the full body tattoo, the kind of carnival woman style of tattooing. But she takes in the image of an eye into Sai's tattoo parlor and asks him to kind of repeat it all over her body. And the reason for that was probably political, actually. When you're looking at tattooing, you can't really get away from the human body. It's kind of an integral part of the craft. It's the canvas on which everything's painted. And, you know, I'm a young female novelist. Obviously, female body is kind of an important issue to me and also to the character of Grace. So the idea of the eye is it's kind of an interruption of the male gaze. It equals it. And I was interested in setting her character up in this way. You know, she's a thoughtful character, and she's going to create a statement. And this is why she chooses this image.
So if men stare at her, they have eyes staring back.
Exactly, yeah.
And in her case, not to reveal too much of the plot here, but I will. I'm going to reveal. It's the idea that she does not put this on the parts of her body that would normally be exposed.
Right.
One has to pay to see this.
That's right. Yeah. She, no facial, no hand tattooing. Yeah, it's just everywhere else, kind of like an undersuit.
Now, why Coney Island? Why set the second part of the book there?
I think I'm terribly fond of Brooklyn. I have a very dear friend that lives there and have spent quite a lot of time with her and love the area. And I really like Coney Island. It's, again, it has a lot of atmosphere to it. And there are similarities with Morecambe. It's another seaside town that's kind of had its heyday and has kind of come down in the world slightly, but is no less attractive, really, for it, and is looking for some kind of revitalization. So I think that's why I kind of wanted to mirror Morecambe, but on a grander scale, because there is this idea of the liberation of America and anything's possible. And so, you know, Coney Island seemed to be that to Morecambe Bay. It seemed to be the bigger, brighter version of it.
Mm-hmm. And you set this in the 30s and 40s primarily. And your earlier book had been set in the 30s. What is it about that era?
I don't know. I think it's the skirts. I quite like them. I just like that style. I'm not really sure. I think it's an interesting period in history, particularly, again, for women, because you're seeing some interesting developments relating to the war a lot of the time. You know, women given more kind of a traditionally masculine role in society, you know, having to operate machinery and drive vehicles while guys are away in the war. And then those rights are kind of repealed, really, when the men arrive home. And so I was interested in kind of, you know, how does that affect the psyche? How does that affect, you know, psychologically? How did it affect women? So it's an interesting time in that regard. And just the two war periods, I think, we're still learning lessons from that period, you know, and it's still a very important period to us. We still have people who remember this time. And again, I'm intrigued by it. I think it's vital that we kind of, you know, keep looking at what this period meant to us.
Are you going to go to that well again for your next book?
I'm not sure, actually. I might. I'm trying to kind of move into other areas too. I like to try and keep each book very different, even if the time period's the same. So I think I probably will end up back there, but at the moment I'm working on something which is contemporary. So it's another departure.
Are the skirts good in a contemporary sense?
Yes, they are. They are.
I was wondering if you might give us one more reading, and this is about a facet of life in Morecambe, at least the way you set it up in The Electric Michelangelo, where Cy, who, as we've been describing, led a very adult life as a child, but also he did childhood things, and he went to the beach with his friends. And you have this passage there about quicksand.
Yes.
That I've never heard described quite as vibrantly as you.
Oh, thank you.
But tell us a little bit about that, because you talk there about how children in the town are warned about the quicksand.
Yeah, that's right. And again, I think I was thinking about childhood and the vivid things that you remember and the terrible things that you're told, which aren't actually terrible. They're just kind of cautionary things. And inevitably, everybody's childhood seems to contain these. And one of the things about Morecambe Bay is it has a very, very famous beach, famous because it has these terrible quicksands, but also a very, very fast tide to it. So it's a notoriously dangerous piece of beach, which is strange for a holiday resort town, but there you go. And again, a couple of years ago, you know, there was a terrible incident with some fishermen being drowned. They were out cockling on the sands, and the tide came in and took them away. So between the quicksands and the really fast tide, there's a lot of danger. So the children of the town, yeah, and even as far up the coast as we were, away from Morecambe, we were told about these quicksands. But of course, the kids in the town, I think, go out there and examine them a lot of the time and play around and get into trouble.
And the children are warned what to do should you fall in there.
That's right, yes. You're not supposed to scream and struggle. You're supposed to stay very, very still and wait for help to come, which, again, is a terribly haunting thing to, you know, to be told as a child. So every so often, a child from Morecambe would actually wander out on the beach at low tide where they should not go, perhaps collecting shells or rock pooling, perhaps under the spell of the brewing fog that rolled in from time to time, and they would step through a patch of live sand and not step out again. And they would struggle, because it's human nature to fight for life when it's being taken, and nobody would hear the screams and come to help, even though it had been promised. Only the cold, disdainful Irish Sea would hear the calls and come up to investigate, that fickle arm of the Atlantic Ocean which had in part set up the trap. In it would rush and smooth over the strange, lumpy, depressed portion of the beach, where the wet, scuffled tracks and the trenched handprints were, smoothing it over like glass, as if complicit in a murder, as if further employed in the conspiracy to get rid of the evidence. And the child would join the company of a few others inside the tightest, sludgiest, densest of bellies, and crack like an egg the child would go, and thick, wet sand would seep into his mouth and ears, setting him in the last position his limbs could move into. And out would come the search parties and the guides and the police when little Charlie didn't come home at tea time. A scarf would eventually be found, or a glove, a shoe, a fishing net, too light to be a decent meal for the hungry sand, and so it was left above ground, moved around by the sea, and brought up to the piers by the police sergeant to be recognised by a now hysterical mother. And then the game in the school playgrounds of quicksands would start up again in earnest, and the shrieks of panicking children would echo over to Charlie Jessop's house on Royal Street, where his mother would be looking at a photograph of her son, who the wretched Morecambe quicksand had made eternally 7 years old.
Sarah Hall reading from her novel, The Electric Michelangelo. You give place and description as much importance as characters, I think.
I really do, and it's something I try to do. The places that I'm fond of stay with me so vividly and are so important. And I find that I don't really know if you can separate character and place too much. So I do. I try and kind of set the scene as well as I can for the reader, to the point where I'm really trying to paint the sets all around the action. It's funny, my publisher in Britain has coined the phrase geofiction when he's talking about the work now, which is just, you know, one of those gimmicks to talk about writing, I'm sure. But yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, I think every writer will place stress on certain things that are important to them, but landscape, and it's possibly being brought up in one of the most dramatic landscapes of Britain, the northwest of England, the Lake District, really is stunning that way. I think that may have something to do with why I write the way I do.
Well, speaking of place and sense of place, you divide your time between England, the north of England?
That's right, yeah.
And North Carolina?
That's right, yeah. Yeah, I've lived in North Carolina for a few years, and I'm quite busy with travel at the moment, so I'm kind of dotting around all over the place, but can't manage to touch base in North Carolina, you know, 3 or 4 times a year, which is lovely. And I really like the state, I do.
Well, you spend so much time in The Electric Michelangelo writing about the coasts and the kinds of people that are there, and tattooing, of course. You made the case that it got its start more along the coastal areas, right? Perhaps because of sailors.
I think so, yeah. The naval tradition influenced that.
Have you spent much time on the North Carolina coast?
Do you know, I went for the first time last summer. I went to the Outer Banks and arrived and literally had to sit down on the beach and have a moment. I couldn't believe how beautiful it was and that I'd never been before. Admittedly, it's a very long drive. I always forget how wide this state is. But I just arrived and kind of sat there and looked out at the sea and I thought, you know, good Lord, Britain's over the other side somewhere. And I could almost feel myself waving at people. It was so expansive and beautiful, stunning.
Any plans to set a book here in North Carolina?
You know, I would absolutely love to, but I'm deeply intimidated. When it comes to writing about the South, the American South, there's such good fiction. You know, the writers that have done it before have done it so well that I'd really want to sit on an idea and work on it before attempting it.
We'd love to see some geofiction about the South. So,
well, thank you.
Sarah Hall, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah Hall is author of The Electric Michelangelo, which had been a nominee for the Booker Prize.
That's right. Yeah, last year.
Sarah, thank you.
Thanks.